stand for the Pledge of Allegiance.
Okay, I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay. All right, let the record show. We on? Yeah. Let the record show that this is a quorum, that this meeting has a quorum and that has been properly advertised. All members are present. This is a public... Oh, Marty Seitz is not here. Excuse me. I'll probably see him walk in any minute. This is a public hearing of the Dewey Beach Planning Commission. There he is.
Okay.
Hey, Marty.
I'm just
you're right on time. We started early because we got tired of... Okay, for the record, all Planning Commission members are in attendance. This is a public hearing of the Dewey Beach Planning Commission. The purpose is to consider the potential amendments to the zoning code of the town of Dewey Beach relating to sea and bay level rise as it affects Dewey Beach and possible adaptation of strategies that the town might incorporate into its planning and zoning code to mitigate flood loss impacts in the future. I'd like to start the meeting by seeing if we can approve the minutes of the August 24th meeting, which also pertained to sea level rise. Everyone's got read a copy of that. Mm-hmm. And
I'll make a motion to approve the minutes.
Okay.
The minutes that I looked at, there was a question mark dated by a person that was put in the draft minutes in the attendance. And I'm wondering, are we going to be publishing attendees' names in all meetings, or is this just something you thought you would like to do?
Well, we've done this generally as a matter of course, and I think the question was spelling.
Spelling of the guy's name. Yeah.
And I will...
There it is.
Yeah, and actually I've corrected that, so I should have deleted the question marks.
Okay, great.
So I will delete the question marks.
Second.
Okay, it has been moved and seconded to approve the minutes of the August 24th meeting.
With a minor correction.
With a minor correction about spelling and removal of the question marks. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Thank you. The materials at the back of the room are the agenda, the draft minutes from the August 24th meeting, a document entitled Sea Level Rise Input for the September 28th PNC meeting that was prepared by David King. Thank you very much, David. Sea Level Rise Scenarios Map of Dewey Beach prepared by the Delaware Coastal Programs, Sea Level Rise Definition List, and I also made copies of Chapter 101 Floodplain Management since we would might be wanting to refer to that. I want to state going first of all that the reason that we're here is to establish a set of priorities and strategies to guide the town. So we're not really, you know, David gave me a call early in the week and said, you know, that there was concern between him and the town manager that we might be moving a little too fast and that the commissioners weren't really at the same level of the sea level rise issue as the Planning Commission apparently is. And that, so I just wanted to state for the record that we're really here just to create a guide for them. This is what we're trying to accomplish. So with that being said, I think we should turn to the sea level rise input for September 28th meeting that was prepared by David and begin the list of amendments, and this is where the 101 might come in handy.
Yeah. Do you want me to read through this?
Yes, why don't you please?
Okay. So the top of this, there's nationwide, there's been a lot of talk about sea level rise, and municipalities and communities are beginning to struggle with how to create resilient communities in the face of sea level rise. And they've begun talking in terms of four major strategies. And those are protection of people, property, and infrastructure, which could include soft and hard armoring, amongst other things. adaptation of how and where one builds, so you don't build in a floodplain if you have that option. You elevate your structure if you're building a new structure so that you at least conform to FEMA guidelines, put you out of, reduces your flood risk. Planned retreat is another option that a lot of communities are taking, where they retreat from areas of high-risk flooding. And you'll, if you follow the literature, you'll see a lot of discussion about abandonment of properties, abandonment of infrastructure. And then the fourth is preservation of natural resources. And clearly there is some tension or conflict between these different strategies, and you know, that's why it's difficult to move forward with one piece of the puzzle when you don't have a master plan, when you don't know where you're going to use protection. You know, even on Reed Avenue, the question is, do you build a 6-foot seawall? Do you abandon the roadway at the end of Reed Street? Do you condemn the properties? Do you let them elevate the properties? Do you take action to preserve the wetland at the end of McKinley Street? So there's, you know, it's hard for a municipality, and I think it's certainly the way I think about it, it's hard to think about what we should do in any specific instance until we as a town decide how we want to approach this more comprehensively. The next bit is just a little data. FEMA's 2012...
Let me just comment on that. I would say that I think the interest of this commission is to recommend a strategy to the commissioners with public input that we have, and let the commissioners bring it to the public to vote on it, and that's how we get to the consensus on what the town needs to be doing in this regard. In other words, that's how we develop that strategy. So I think that, you know, we're on the right track, but we're going to have to pick maybe conflicted strategy and then recommend that to the commissioners. I think that's sort of the follow-on of what you're suggesting.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that's in line with the path that we have taken. So the 1% annual chance, so based on 2012 FEMA modeling, the 1% annual flooding level in Dewey Beach is about 5 feet. Now, to put that in context, the Route 1 down by Dickinson Street is about 5 feet. And up by McKinley is probably 5.5 feet. Bill, do you have a...
They're pretty close.
Pretty close, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, there is some increase in elevation as you go north, but
minimal.
Not a lot at that point. So, you know, there's every year there's a 1% chance that we're going to have water on Route 1 on most of the Bayside. And I think we've seen this most of the last 4 or 5 years. You know, we've had a 100-year storm almost every year. And at the last meeting, we were asked about, what is the level, what is, you know, the elevation of the bay in the Dewey vicinity? And I just point to the tide gauge, the Dewey Beach tide gauge, maintained by the United States Geological Society. And some information about flood levels for Sandy in the storm of 62. Sandy was recorded at 5.3 feet, and estimates of the storm of 62 were 7 feet, to put all of this in context. So in creating this document for our review and discussion, I was working off comments at the last meeting and the document we used at the last meeting, and I tried to sort things into issues I thought we could deal with in the near term, medium term, issues we need more information with, and then issues that are longer term or philosophical issues that at some point we should put forward to the commissioners for them to make policy decisions. So the first set of issues are pages 1 through 4. The first one is, I think, to some extent is a housekeeping issue, and to some extent is a policy recommendation, and that is to amend section 101-6, coastal floodplain area to amend 101-6, coastal floodplain area, by amending the subsections A, B, and C to explicitly mention VE, AE, and AO special hazard areas. As our code is currently written, coastal high hazard is basically the VE zones. General floodplain areas are AE zones, and areas of shallow flooding are AO zones. If you dig into the code and read it, that's what you come away with. The normal person reading this and trying to compare this to the flood insurance risk maps or the scenario maps are going to see on those maps it's VEAEAO. Our code talks about coastal high hazard, general floodplain, and areas of shallow flooding as areas in the floodplain. And so, I mean, my recommendation would be that we, at least as a minimum, amend that section to, you know, parenthetically say, you know, on the firm maps, this is the VE zone, and just so it's explicit.
Okay. David, I support that. I think we ought to include what all this stands for in the actual definitions also.
Fine.
To put that into the definition so everybody understands what it means.
Now, the alternative bullet, since our code does kind of talk about floodplain management in coastal high hazard areas, we could choose to define that either as the VE zone or as anything channelward or seaward of the limit of moderate wave action, which if you look at the copy of the flood insurance risk map, those two areas don't exactly overlap. It's more noticeable on the bay side where the black and white dotted line is the limit of moderate wave action, and the first solid white line on landward of the base shore is the VEAE boundary. So this black line is the VEAE zone boundary. I'm sorry, the white line, solid white line is the VEAE zone boundary, and the black and white dotted line is the limit of moderate wave action. On the ocean side, they almost superimpose. And it's unfortunate that we don't have a blow up of the map that shows the dune line superimposed on this to see where those fall relative to the dune.
That can be done.
And I suspect you could do it.
Yeah.
Do we have any consensus for either the simple amendment or the alternative definition? Would we need to, if we chose the definition that you just spoke about, would we need to include this? We would need to include a map in the code as well.
Well, I don't know if we would have to do that. I mean, the map in principle can get updated.
That's where I was going. That's where
As you know, whenever FEMA last did the maps, I don't know, 15 years ago. Bill, do you know when?
What?
FEMA's last update on the firm maps?
These right here were just done.
Well, I know, but when was the last?
Prior to that, before my time.
Yeah. So it was sometime in the 90s, or maybe earlier. Maybe it was 88 or something, because I don't know.
I think it was in the 90s. So the wording would be that we adapt the current version of the FEMA map in the code. In other words, if they update it next year or 10 years from now, that would be the map that we're referring to.
Right, and so this would be then, the code would be a living document as the maps get updated by FEMA.
You might not see the current map in the code, but you would see the reference to the current map, and you'd have to find out what FEMA's current map is. So and that's the way you would handle that, right? We're not talking about a 20-year-old map that's been out of date in our code and out.
I would think so. Now, of course, this is something we can...
Well, it's sort of like the IBCC code. Every time it changes, in our zoning code, we've accepted... I think our charter says we accept whatever the town...
Right.
So it would be the same, I think, in this. We would make a special change with the FEMA.
So you FEMA say that the example you use is the Beverage Control Board, IBBC?
No, the International Building Code.
Oh, I see. I bet you.
But it's the same principle, basically. You called the question, are we okay?
I think that, no, it doesn't sound like we are. I mean, I personally...
I mean, I don't know.
I'm liking the simple amendment a little bit better because it's simpler.
You know, we
I'm
may...
the same place.
Right? Yeah.
I guess I'm not even totally following the thought. I'm understanding what we're saying about the map, but I don't really understand the necessity of going there. I think the simple amendment is the easiest way, or the simplest way, and the easiest understood.
That's the ultimate goal is to make it the reader understand what this is, you know.
Right.
And the alternative is a little more stringent in terms of increasing the resilience of the town to flooding by including in this quote unquote coastal high hazard area. Not just the VE, which is the high velocity wave action district, but the area of moderate wave action. And we could certainly decide to not do this now, and if this becomes an issue in 5 years, to readdress it.
Well, that might be broken, but I can simply that.
I think we need to have the AEVE and AO in this definition in 101. I definitely think that.
So, I mean, to some extent, this is just to make the code easier for the layperson to pick up and in the definitions
and
as well.
And the definition section, right.
So is the consensus to keep it as a simple amendment?
Yeah, we can go with that, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think that's fine.
Do we need to take a vote on that to get past it, do you think? Or do you want to just say we have a consensus on that? I mean, I think we're okay as far as wording the advertising.
I think my goal was to not come out of here with any
firm thing.
Votes, per se. But this would lead to a draft for whenever, basically a draft.
Right.
That we could circulate for comment, and then we could advertise that specifically for a vote at the next meeting. So I can do that. The second one has to do with increasing freeboard. And you'll see as I was thinking about this, a lot of questions came up. And I thought when I first put it as number two, I thought it was important to decide where we would set the freeboard requirement. If we were going to increase it for discussion for some of the other items. And personally, I'm more confused about this and how I feel about this than I was a month ago. And I would I would like to see this moved into discussions about the comprehensive plan.
Can I interrupt you just one second? I see that we now have 5 members of the public in attendance, so thank you for coming. But I also would like to let you all know that this is a public hearing, and by all you have to do to participate in this public hearing is raise your hand, and we'll recognize you, and you can get in on this discussion. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. So I would like to delay further discussion of this particular item, which would be increasing freeboard from 1 foot to 2 foot for anybody in the AE and VE zones, which is most of the Bayside Basin.
Are you saying the whole section,
all of the discussions on point 2, which is 101-11, to move those into discussions on the comprehensive plan? Because you're going to get, there are a lot of those buildings are 35 feet, and you're going to get into discussion of, you know, people who preemptively want to raise their building to 35 feet because it gives them a better view or blocks the view of the neighbor behind them who they don't like, or...
Dave, are you talking about also maybe changing the freeboard for certain areas? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, this was to change it for all areas in the floodplain, or at least for the VE and the AE.
Well, I mean, if you're going to do it for one, you're going to have to do it for all.
Yeah, and so I guess it would also be the AO zone. And,
right.
Which expands even further the number of properties that, and again, this would be for new construction, or substantial improvements. But I think I would like to just postpone this discussion to a future meeting.
I think we're going to need a series of meetings on this one.
Well, yeah.
Only
and that's why I thought it was important.
It's a complicated issue.
I mean, it's going to go into broaching 35 feet.
Right.
And, you know, that's...
And there are other issues that I think we should be taking a look at is properties in non-conforming areas that are in flood zones, which is probably most of them, and possibly looking at if people want to fix up their property. And right now, there's no incentive to do a whole lot with these old properties. That maybe we can put some considerations in and incentives for people to fix up their property, come into flood standards without, you know, increasing massive height levels and square footage of their house. But I think it would be an incentive for people, certainly insurance-wise, and I think it would help, for lack of a better word, beautify the town a little bit.
Yeah, I think it goes further than that, though. You know, really, I mean, we have to wrap our minds around whether or not, I mean, the condition, the nonconformities, you know, it's nonconforming. So the thought is that sometime in the next 50, 100 years, that they will become conforming through properties that are being purchased next door, combining properties, doing whatever that will. That's the thought. And the more I think about that, the more it seems like such a stretch. I don't feel that that's really a possibility for our town. I mean, it's one way of looking at it, but I don't think it's really going to happen, you know? And so maybe we should embrace the nonconformities and help them, you know?
That's where I was going on that, is to do that, not to make massive changes and hope that in the future people are going to combine properties. It seems to me we have to deal with the here and now.
It's a long shot.
It is a long shot. And, you know, some people can get flooding if they can't substantially meet the standards. Because of nonconformity, they can't repair properties.
I'm with you.
So I think that's something we should table.
I'm not following the right. Are we talking about the non-conforming of the height of the building in reference to the flood zone or the setbacks?
It could be setbacks.
Okay. Because you don't really have the capability of allowing a non-conforming building to be rebuilt or added onto unless you set it according to the FEMA to the 100-year elevation of FEMA standards, or you'll be out of compliance with your insurance rates here.
Right.
So you don't really, you know, in other words, if you have a non-conforming building that's below elevation, and they want to build an addition to it to make it nicer, that addition has to come up, regardless of what the finished floor of the existing house is. It has to come up.
Right.
Or you'll be in violation, like Ballard's Beach was doing.
Yeah. Right.
Setbacks is another thing. I don't know if we're talking about that with the freeboard or not.
I think what we're talking about, it's kind of a package, because if we supposedly allow somebody to go higher than what they can in the comprehensive, but still within the 35 foot, if they go higher right now, they have to meet setbacks. Anything higher now has to meet setbacks from which we exist. So, I mean, we would have to take that into consideration with allowing somebody to come up above the floodplain.
I would think your setback shouldn't be changed. If they prove that they think that's a hardship because of the zoning regulations and the FEMA regulations, then you go to the Board of Adjustment and say you have a hardship.
Well, that's the whole discussion.
And that's it. They can always go to the Board of Adjustment.
That's a Board of Adjustment call, because you've got your setbacks. I don't think you can design setbacks to meet every non-conforming situation or a general non-conforming situation. You have to set a standard, which is what we have.
But is there any portion of that discussion that we could make it across the board? I mean, is there portions of that?
I mean, this is to some extent item 3 on this list.
Right. There is. I think there's an in-between here, but that, if we table this for another time, I think that's a much broader discussion.
Yeah, it could be, it could be something that we could think about, maybe get together in a workshop, when everybody can spend some time and throw out your ideas and your history of town that you had and say, look, this is what I see.
I looked at the combination of properties and so forth. I agree with Harry that I think there's probably two properties that are going to combine to make it a conforming property in the next 50 years, maybe 3. But not, it's not going to be a significant effect. But we can still have that in there. That's fine. If it happens, it happens. But I think that what I look for, what I would encourage, is sort of the philosophy that we're working to encourage the continued occupation of residents that currently exist, whether they're conforming or not conforming, and we're encouraging the investment of the owner in that property, for improvements and so forth, and including some flood abatement, for example, this raising the freeboard or whatever, as being something that I would think that we want to advocate to the commissioners that's kind of our basic philosophy. And now the details of whether, in fact, now you're going above 35 feet, maybe you can't allow above 35 feet, but there's plenty of one- and two-story buildings that are not conforming that could benefit from being raised up and the owner adding investment to that property. And it would then be consistent with the philosophy that I just stated.
I think I totally agree with you. I think there's some issues that others might have with the good intentions we have. For example, if we allow somebody to go up and somebody's view is blocked from the water, I mean, they might object to that.
Right, I agree.
So those are the sensitive issues we would have to, little landmines we got to avoid.
Well, that's why we have a public hearing, and why
right.
We go through this process.
Right. I agree totally with what you said.
Is that what you're looking for, Dave?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. So item 3... is, so the thought was 18560B reads currently that a building non-conforming only as to height, area, or bulk requirements may be altered or extended, providing such alteration or extension does not increase the degree of non-conformity in any respect. It goes on to say, and this is the issue that I think we need to address, a building which does not conform to the required setbacks in any respect shall not be expanded either vertically or horizontally in the setback area. So if there is a building, and there are several buildings, I believe, in town that encroach in the required yards and the setbacks, that are not built to FEMA standards, that are one story or maybe two stories, that one of them one of them was damaged, specifically was damaged in Hurricane Sandy. And apparently they will not get the insurance payment if they do not rebuild the FEMA standards. This section of code could be read to prohibit them from building to FEMA standards because they can't move the house to a different part of their property so as to not encroach in the setbacks. So,
and the only recourse they would have is to take it to the Board of Adjustment.
And they can always take it to the Board of Adjustment, and we could just say we're happy with the code the way it is and have them take it to the Board of Adjustment. Or we can modify the code so that the next time this happens, they don't have to go to the Board of Adjustment. Or we can modify, and then there are a number of question and discussion points down here. You know, the question might be, so if we had changed the code to be proactive rather than reactive, so that it would say, you know, if somebody were in that situation, we will let them elevate their building before there's a loss, then, you know, maybe they wouldn't have had the loss. And is that a good thing to do or a bad thing to do? You know, again, would you let somebody whose building was 35 feet built on grade to elevate it to 5 feet above grade so they meet FEMA standards, but then the roof line's at 40 feet as a preemptive issue, or would you let them do that if they have substantial damage as defined by the town or FEMA and have to rebuild to FEMA standards? Are you going to let them go above 35 feet, or are you going to say, we're going to let you, you know, rebuild, but you have to stay within the 35 foot?
So you got to cut the third floor off.
Or cut the first floor off. Now, you realize that, I mean, FEMA defines substantial damage as 50%. Of the pre-damage value of the structure. I can't remember if it's 50% over a 5-year period or 50% for the event. I mean, they do, but so, you know, so your structure has to be significantly damaged before FEMA is going to say you have to elevate it. And maybe if your structure's damaged at the 50% level, you ought to just tear it down and build something from scratch rather than trying to deal with jacking it up. I mean,
Mrs. Danaher, or Commissioner Danaher had a question.
That's the first time anybody's. Is there any way of knowing in all these categories and scenarios how many properties you're talking about? Maybe Mr. Mears knows. Are we talking about only 5 fall in this category and 45? It seems like that might affect the way you approach writing the code if you know that you've got only 3 dwellings parcels that fall into a certain category, or maybe. I'm really a beginner on this stuff, so I respect whatever you're doing. I just wonder if the magnitude of the groups affects your planning in any way.
Bill, do we have a sense on that at all?
I would say it's over 50% of the towns in that, you know, in that criteria.
Really?
And the several groups that David King described.
Yeah, because a lot of these places that have just been built in the past 14 years I've been here are the only ones that I know meet flood elevation, and prior to that, the ones, you know, when Mr. Fader was here, there's some of them that were built back then that don't meet the FEMA standards.
Now I want to, before Gail, you say something, I want to kind of focus us a little. This item 3 is specifically about buildings that encroach in the setbacks. Which is a smaller, you know, so it's buildings that encroach in the setbacks that are not built to FEMA standards. So it's, it takes a number of properties out of the basket, but it's probably a significant number of the properties, residential properties in the Bayside Basin. You know, all of these properties on half lots on Reed and McKinley and Vista and Buena and,
We also have density issues on 5,000 square foot lots, where we have 5,000 square foot lots where we have more than two dwellings on a 5,000 square foot lot in the town. Still.
But they're not, item three, item three was specifically geared to doing something. When I prepared this, I tried to narrow down each of the items in a more manageable bite. But, I mean, that is an issue that ultimately needs to be addressed. But this was, I tried to just...
Well, hey, might I add something else to, there's only three dwellings now, since the zoning code has changed, that meets the zoning code. Because since we changed all the setbacks in all the areas, all the other places built prior to the zoning code were non-conforming.
Anyway, I was just trying to deal with the ones that, well, you're right. You're right.
I guess Commissioner Danaher, the answer is there's a lot of properties in this category.
Kind of affects the way you do this.
So one of the bullet points was to maybe just limit any change to this section to structures that experience substantial damage, to provide them some relief, as Marty suggested, to stay in their house.
That would be my suggestion, is to not get into the potential of damage and just look at, okay, you've had damage, we can help you.
I mean, that makes it easier. You know, it makes our discussion easier, but, you know, sure would make a lot more sense to allow people to make the changes to their homes that they want to do to avoid that type of thing, you know?
Well, they can always go to the Board of Adjustment. Mm-hmm.
Yes. We could throw that term out all day long.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I know.
That's,
I know.
It's like telling them to apply kite, because chances to get something changed by the Board of Adjustment is slim.
Right. The Board of Adjustment is going to get real busy here.
Yeah. Well, and the reason to incorporate this in the zoning, this change in the zoning code, was to provide more immediate relief than having to go to the Board of Adjustment.
Dale, you had your hand up?
Yeah, first of all, I'd say that I think you all have done an outstanding job in general, what you've done so far. The only thing I worry about, or one of the things I worry about, is that the idea of not allowing non-conforming a leeway presently is so that it eventually, the whole idea of zoning, is that eventually they become conforming. The idea behind allowing any non-conforming building is, we've changed the zoning code, you're non-conforming, you don't quite meet the standards, but eventually you have to meet them. And if you go too far with trying to help people stay in their houses, if you go too far with changing your zoning code to accommodate everything, then you've got to say, we're going to go back to, you know, half lots. We're going to go back to allowing houses that extend past there, you know, for whatever reason, because everybody is going to have a reason, and a valid reason, you know, in their mind, and semi-valid maybe in your mind. So be careful how far you go, because the whole intent of a zoning code is to make things conforming to meet the future of what's good for the town and the overall public. That doesn't help much, but that's the idea.
I agree along those lines. If you try to if you try to appease or benefit everyone who is non-conforming and work with them individually, then you're going to just destroy any type of planning, comprehensive planning and zoning that we're trying to establish. And you know, somebody has a true hardship. I know you don't have to hear the Board of Adjustment, but that's their right to bring it to the board. They can supply a site plan that shows what's going on with the hardship and present facts. And then it becomes, you know, a legal issue. I mean, it can even go beyond the Board of Adjustment to the next level. Litigation, you know, to prove they have a hardship and you know, get it resolved that way. At least there's a continued path to get it resolved and go as far as they can with it.
So you would feel we shouldn't make any amendments at this point in time to this particular piece of code.
I'm not ruling that all altogether, but what I'm saying is, as I agree with Dale, that you know we got to be how careful how widely and openly we start considering all the non-conforming properties in town.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
There are pathways for non-conforming properties to use to, you know, stake their case and to continue having a quality of life. But there's so many of them in town. What are you going to do? There's just too many to consider.
Well, and then maybe that's a good point.
Following up on what Dale had suggested was, or offered as a consideration, is to maybe not just exempt everybody, but look at the repetitive loss structures, which really narrows it down to people that have actually had severe impacts, and maybe exempt them or provide an easier path for them to go to the Board of Adjustment to and maybe waive the fee or something to that so that they can do a consideration and then make sure we know what repetitive loss means. So make it very clear. So not anybody can just go there and just say, look, I'm at risk, so I want to, you know, redo everything.
Yeah, but should that person who hasn't yet sustained the loss, should we restrict them and subject them to the laws in the future?
No, I don't think, technically the whole town's at risk.
Exactly.
My sense is that a lot of people probably aren't going to take advantage of this right away because it's a very costly figure to raise and elevate homes. And I think following up on what Dan was saying is if everybody jumps into this, then what's the incentive to go from non-conforming to conforming? Probably not. The reality is, I don't know that anybody's going to be doing it anytime soon anyway, because, you know, how can you become conforming if you've got a 40 by 80 lot? You can't. It's impossible.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a little bit of...
That's following Marty's point.
You know, I mean, Dale had runs up a valid point, but I don't think I never thought of the goal of zoning to have 100% compliance or 100% conforming. I think it's a way to instill a path forward that's in a structured manner. The fact that we have a town that has non-conforming properties and residents is part of the charm and things that people are trying to preserve in Dewey Beach, including some of the commissioners. So, you know, there's not an interest in pushing these people out of their properties or giving them a 10-year deadline to conform or
yeah, I just had a thought along those lines, Martin, not to interrupt you, but I've worked in areas where there are existing lots and existing houses, and the majority do not conform. And every time one is demolished for whatever reasons and torn down, the zoning official or whoever looks at the character of that block and makes a decision upon what this person wants to do to replace their house. Does it fit into the character of the block? Not necessarily the zoning setback. Neighborhoods I'm thinking, for instance, you know, the houses are within 10 feet of the property line versus the zoning requirement of 25 feet. You know, if they were to enact a 25-foot setback, they're really in 10 feet. And most of the houses on that block are either 10 feet closer, or, you know, 10 feet or closer or 12 feet or 15 feet, that zoning official has the authority to say, well, you comply with the character of that lot, we'll let you rebuild there, not pushing you back to the required building setback line, and be the only person on the block who is back there, and probably make your building unlivable.
Right. So you maintain a nonconformity.
You maintain the nonconformity, but yeah.
So, but I think that's a valid approach, and I think that's the approach that the town uses. Is that correct? I mean, I think it's not quite that we're getting everybody conforming. It's that we're looking at the character of that block,
right,
and their neighbors, and whether.
Well, except that.
I think that's what the Board of Adjustment may look into, but I don't believe the building inspector doesn't have that authority to do all these waivers.
In point of fact,
it was averaging. Remember,
in 2000 and prior to 2009, Dewey had exactly that provision in its code that if your neighbors were all built at 10-foot setbacks, and it was the average of
averaging,
right,
like three lots on either side or something, then you could build forward, and that got taken out because people went from building one-story structures at the 10-foot setback to building three-story structures, pushing them up to the 10-foot setback. And, you know, Bill couldn't say you can build 10 feet setback one story. Mm-hmm. But if you want to go three stories, you've got to go back. It was, they could build to the average, but they could go up 35 feet. And people were building different, you know, it was...
I think we're on the path of probably eventually getting something that would work with these non-conforming properties, working on those possible intrusions that it would be, but that's still allowing the character of the block to be maintained without causing hardships. And I think that's something we can continue discussing, how do we resolve that.
But I sense that the feeling is, if we're only going to deal with one or two issues a year, that's better for the Board of Adjustment to deal with them at this point and to table this discussion at this point in time, where we don't know, as Ellen said, we don't know what the inventory is.
But I wouldn't table the entire discussion, because if somebody, and we do have properties that get massive storm damage, there ought to be a way that they can meet the FEMA standard and be able to, without having to go to the Board of Adjustments, to build basically what they've got, go up to the foot without go up whatever, another 2 or 3 feet, not in exactly what they've got for the most part, just raise it up 2 feet. I don't see an issue. The bare minimum. Allow them to go to the bare minimum, and as long as it doesn't go above the 35-foot height ceiling.
You could add in there the square footage, clause, maintaining the square footage.
Yeah, it's got to be an increased square footage, and that's pretty much what we've got right now. But the only thing is, we don't have a provision for them to go up a foot or two.
So what is the issue with the Brule home over there? What exactly is her hold up?
What do you mean?
The Brule house.
The Brules.
Well, he's at the elevation now of base flood elevation.
Right.
But he wants to go higher than base flood elevation. He wants to go another 3 foot.
And his reason for that is?
He wants to utilize underneath the house.
Well,
that he was never able to do before.
From what I understand, there was a concern about his insurance rate would go lower the higher you
that's
a financial issue, and I don't know that the Board of Adjustment, I think the issue ought to be is that the person should be able to build to the FEMA, whatever the FEMA requirements are, and that's it for the time. Anything other than that, they take it to the Board of Adjustment.
FEMA plus what other restrictions that the town has on top of it.
Right, exactly. I mean, these are complex issues, because think about the person who has his property is completely flooded out. He's got a 14-foot house in height. All right, so we told him to build back, but his ceilings and his inside were six and a half feet. Now, do we want him to build a 6.5-foot ceiling, or do we want him to come back to some sort of safety standard that we would allow? I mean, so that's where it gets a little complex.
My initial feeling is that we should try to accommodate it. Try to make that house as nice as it can be.
Well, I think it's going to improve the neighborhood as long as it doesn't impact on increasing square footage and blocking, a major blocking of people's views of the water that they already have.
But, I mean, you're talking about raising the, potentially, raising the roof line a couple of feet on the first floor, a couple of feet on the second floor, a couple of feet to meet FEMA. I mean, you could be raising the roof line 10 feet.
Potentially.
But as always, I mean, that's... Which will take my view from...
That, as I said, that becomes... Then that would be a Board of Adjustment issue. But that's why these are very complex issues.
Right, and 185.59 talks about rebuilding to essentially the same configuration, well, is the term they use, which, I think means the same. I would say to, talk about the building envelope or something.
Well, there's a question is, if you don't meet current building standards, how do you go to the current building standards? You couldn't get a permit to rebuild your house.
No, you'd have to...
Well, what would you... You'd have to...
You have to tear it all down and start all over again, because
well,
the plumbing's wrong and the electrical's wrong.
No,
and
if you take that position, you couldn't do anything. If you have a six-foot... And we do have some very small ceilings in these homes. And if you can't build to the FEMA standard plus that, you can't rebuild your property. So it's dead property. I mean, these are the considerations I think we should consider.
Well, we're trying to.
I know. But that's why I say it's a complex issue. We probably need some more of a workshop on this and more input from people.
So it's safe to say that with the consensus is that we should, I'm hearing everyone here today, is that we should try to accommodate a property that's been repetitively damaged and make it, let the Board of Adjustment and the whole entire town know that we are friendly towards this type of thing, and that maybe that would guide the Board of Adjustment in their decisions in some way. I mean, some type of statement, a policy that the town would operate by.
I agree. I think you could probably argue before the Board of Adjustments that this isn't just an economic issue. It's a safety issue for residents living in a house that are subject to storm damage, severe storm and flood issues. And we could create a path for people who have had a loss, or substantial, whatever, however we define that, to be able to build to a FEMA standard without increasing square footage.
I just maybe throw this in a suggestion. Typically, if a person goes to a Board of Adjustment, in a municipality, that municipality has the luxury of having a sister department like the planning department or public works department, something that would review what they want to do and all the consequences and things that go on. And then they would make a recommendation to the Board of Adjustment what they would recommend the Board of Adjustment do. Now, the Board of Adjustment isn't bound to use their decision, but they look at it. Maybe it should come to us first. If a situation like that comes up, and then we review it, make our recommendation to the Board of Adjustment. And if you want to be friendly about it, it would come that way. Like the planning, saying the Planning Commission has reviewed this based upon this and that, we make a recommendation to the Board of Adjustment. And they have the same, they can think about what we said, and they can use it, or they can make the final decision.
We'd probably make a recommendation to the commissioners to adapt this philosophy or whatever that would then maybe influence the Board of Adjustment. But I mean, we have no direct connection with the Board of Adjustment.
Right. Now, that's, you're right, something would have to be done because we would be acting as this sister department, so to speak.
Well, the town does have a direct connection via the building inspector who represents the town's position. So maybe there ought to be some sort of, which I like your suggestion, a friendly... a neutral party that looks at it and makes a friendly recommendation one way or the other.
Because Bill's job is to enforce the 10 codes.
Yeah, right. But there ought to be some a provision,
right,
an in-between step.
I really don't see a negative side to that idea. That's I think I'm with you on that.
And you tell me you don't have to pay for it. Mm-hmm. An engineering or planning firm to review it for you.
Right.
The town can review it.
That's a good suggestion.
So perhaps we should recommend that to the panel.
Okay, I think I sense that we should do something to accommodate for those that have repetitive substantial or substantial storm damage.
Yeah.
FEMA plus one minimum, whatever the town's free board is. Mm-hmm. They can't broach 35 feet, so we don't have to deal with that. The same configuration building envelope, which would keep the roof at the same height. They can do with the interior configuration what they want to. Same square footage, a recommendation from the Planning Commission. Would we... So is everybody okay with at least taking a look at that?
Yeah, I think
I would question the keep the building at the same height. In other words, if you're going to build it within the envelope and you're going to raise the envelope 1 foot or 3 feet.
Now, if you have an 18-foot building on ground and you're going to raise it 3 feet, you have an 18-foot building now 3 feet above ground. So not keeping the roof the same place, but keeping the roof relative to the floor the same.
Yeah. Okay, maybe I'm misinterpreting what
Well, Jim was suggesting letting you add 5 feet to the interior dimension, which
well,
you
wasn't
could,
saying 5 feet. Well, you know, saying yeah. allow them to build to a current standard, to some sort of the county, whatever the current standards are to build in the house. I mean, most homes usually have, what, 8 foot ceilings?
7 foot six is minimum.
All right, so we allow people to build a 7 foot six minimum. I mean, it seems to me that would be a reasonable. If you've got a 6.5 foot, wouldn't you want them to build? Do you want these small little boxes?
Some of them, if they've got a pitched roof, they could do a flat roof. And
most people want 9 foot ceilings these days, but that's just their wish list. But I have a problem setting the roof limit. Maybe you can, if it was a one story house for all general purposes, and no one could argue it's a one story house, just let them rebuild a one story house with the typical roof pitch, whatever it is, and there'll be no living space allowed in the the attic area, so that would limit the roof pitch, and let them build a nice house with a nice roof pitch, rather than limiting how high the roof can go. Just say once if you lost a one-story house, you can replace. You got to come up to FEMA's elevations or above, and build a one-story house with a typical roof line. And no building, no living space in the attic area, and that would limit how high they want to build the roof, or where they want to put the elevation of the roof. And you would still basically achieve what was there. You're going to get a higher roof, but you're going to get a nicer looking house, and it's going to give them a livable house.
I guess I have a little trouble with that because again, we're talking about somebody who encroaches in the setbacks, who under current law can't elevate their building and can't raise their building unless they reconstruct it so it doesn't encroach on the setbacks. So if I'm a neighbor, I have every reason to expect that that building might never be elevated. And if it's going to be elevated, it's going to move away from my building as it's elevated.
I don't know. I let the buyer beware. If you're living next door to a house that's about ready to fall down or looks like it should be replaced, you got to consider someday something different is going to build that lot a little nicer than what's there now, and it's not going to be the same for you. You might have somebody.
My sense is a lot of people would be happy to have somebody rebuild some of these homes that, I wouldn't say ugly, but the beauty's in the eyes of the beholder, but I would think a lot of people would be very happy if they modernized their home and fixed it up, and it would probably increase property values. The only problem I would have is if somebody's water view is substantially obstructed, and I think we could address. I think that's something the Board of Adjustments could deal with.
So, Bill, what happens if? I mean, I assume that if somebody does a 50% improvement on their building, that they have to come up to existing building codes?
Anything that you put on doesn't have to be 50%. You have to come up to building codes.
But
if you put an addition on any dwelling, you have to meet the required building codes in today's standards.
For the whole structure?
No, for the addition.
Just for the addition.
Just for the addition.
I thought there was some place, some...
And Tony, if it's over 50%,
right.
If you increase it over 50%, then the rest of the building has to come up to standards.
So if a house had...
And then if it's in a flood zone, whatever you put on, if it's less than 50%, that can be up to the flood elevation. You don't have to touch the existing dwelling, but if you go over 50% of the area, then everything has to come up to the flood elevation.
So one could argue that if these are buildings that have over 50% damage, that they're going to trigger that. Would we want to let them tear the building down, build essentially the same structure to current building code? I realize this is a slightly different question.
So you're saying 50% loss, they've had a 50% of loss, would we allow them to tear the whole thing down, bring it up to the FEMA standards, and build a new house, the same square footage as the previous one?
Well, and I'm hearing with 7'6" ceilings.
Burnt down. That's
where they're allowed to do that anyway.
Yeah, you're allowed to do that. If it's burnt down, mm-hmm. you're allowed to do that.
But not to elevate it if they encroach on the setbacks.
If it's in a flood zone, in this situation we're dealing with now, we would still have to let them, have their dwelling back in the setback area, but they can't increase the envelope, but they got to bring it up to the flood elevation. After the house is burned down, you're done, if that's what you're trying to say.
The thing is, you're not increasing, you may be increasing the height, but you're not increasing square footage, livable space.
Right.
That's the key here.
Well, but again, I can build a 22-foot atrium that's qualifies as a single story.
Technically, you probably could. Well, we can make some recommendations. You build FEMA standards to current standards. You've got a 6-foot, you can go to 7.5-foot ceiling. You know, as long as you don't go above the 35-foot or infringe on that, what's the problem? Infringing somebody's water, what would be the problem with that?
So you can't infringe on somebody's water view in the code.
It's in the code now?
No, you can't. I mean, I don't think you can.
Well,
that's a difficult one
there. Well, that's something the Board of Adjustment could easily address if somebody wants to file an appeal to the building code. Let's say that's permissible. Somebody could file an appeal within 30 days to the Board of Adjustment asking that...
But if you write it into the code, it's in the code, and they built the code.
Right.
So there is no appeal to it.
Right.
What are you saying? I don't know if that.
Well,
place.
A lot of people. Let's face it. People build.
Doesn't make sense to if somebody gets flooded and you're going to let them elevate.
They have to elevate to rebuild.
Yeah, they got.
Okay. Right. So you're going to let them elevate. Should we let them basically raise the structure, totally demolish it? And then do new construction with the old configuration. So that it's...
I'm trying to look at all scenarios. I'm trying to look at a house that's not totally non-conforming. Are we just staying there if a house is totally non-conforming to building setbacks?
Right. Just with regard to the setbacks.
With regard to the
because
setbacks.
If you're not... If you don't encroach in the setbacks, you have lots of other latitude.
Right.
It's only when you're in the setbacks that you seem to be blocked by this piece of code.
I keep thinking that if a house is totally destroyed and it's a buildable lot with the setbacks, then they have to rebuild according to the setbacks. If it's a lot that's non-conforming, or they can prove that the character of that lot should allow them to encroach beyond the setbacks, then let's think about maybe bringing it to the Planning Commission first to review and then go to Board of Adjustment if that's going to be the case. So if they have a buildable lot and they can build according to setbacks, they got to build. if they don't like that, and if they think it's non-conforming, or if it is non-conforming and they can't build, then you've got to allow them to build. You can't take away that lot property rights. You know, you've got to let them build. There has to be a path to housing and then build. And I think trying to put into code every possible scenario in town is going to be too involved, complicated, and wrong. I think you've got to cut it short and say, you know, make this two or three different typical scenarios, and then say, okay, if you come to this one, you got to come before the planning commission with a site plan, prove your hardship. The planning commission makes a recommendation to the board of adjustment, and the board of adjustment has their say. They still don't like it. They think they have a hardship. They can go to court and challenge what the board of adjustment has given them.
I think we ought to allow them to rebuild.
I'm sorry?
I think we ought to allow them to rebuild. I know that.
Now, you
as
mean
long as
to.
The same footprint.
You're saying to patch it up, rebuild, or are you saying to build from scratch?
Whichever has to be done.
Okay.
If it's less than 50% damage, and they can rebuild half of the residence, then half of it's got to come to code, right? If they rebuild half the house, that half has to come to new code. Is that right? But the old half would not have to.
Well, no, not necessarily. It's in the flood zone now. Then that could be another situation. If you're, you know, whatever you're putting. See, we're talking about flood zones here, I think, mainly.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's a flood zone.
That's the issue. Whatever you take and do in a flood zone, it has to come up to the standards. No matter what, new or rebuild, it's got to come up to standards.
Well, it has come up to the FEMA elevation standards.
Right.
Chuck's asking about the building code.
Well, yeah, if you're rebuilding something. Oh, you mean the, what's existing there?
Right, you got half a house that is destroyed.
Right.
Or less than half.
Right.
49%. I'm going to rebuild that half. I'm still keeping the 50%.
No, I don't think it's... I think it's going to have to meet the whole dwelling's going to have to meet it. I don't think that just half of it's going to be acceptable, because in the situation that we're in this town, these houses, like what's down there now, they're dealing with, then you have your new part here and the old part here, they'd be overlooking the roof.
It's impractical to live.
I mean, it'd be a very odd looking house.
Okay. Yeah, I understand where you are, where I am, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that there ought to be some provisions that you can rebuild. Maybe you have to raise it. But if you build the same structure, the same basic footprint, except now you're up on stilts, you ought to be able to build it.
I would agree.
Setback or no setback.
I agree.
But to base flood elevation and town, whatever, adopts over flood zone.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, see, that's where this individual now is trying to surpass
the base elevation, yeah.
Dale Cook?
Instead of maybe, instead of trying to reinvent the wheel here, maybe there's got to be oodles and oodles of small beach towns in this country that have gone through the same process we're going through now. I mean, there must be lots of them that have gone through the same debate we're going through now. Might be nice to see what they've done. They might have two or three different ideas that we haven't even thought of.
You bring up, we were given an article that came out at the town hall the other day.
That was great.
It was a phenomenal article. It had to do with homes in the West Coast and beach erosion and flooding. And it was all over the place. Some people said, you know, don't build.
Yeah.
It's on you. You know, if you want to live there, we're not doing anything else for beach replenishment.
Yeah.
It's your house, and a lot of people in a very wealthy Santa Monica area, a lot of building owners chipped in millions of dollars to redo the whole area for them, to prevent them.
Well, with the storms that we've had in the last 2 years that have come up the coast, there's got to be lots of towns that have addressed the same problem.
Especially South Carolina, North Carolina.
Yeah.
Yeah, and some of them say once you're inundated, that's it.
That's what's happened in Jersey.
Yeah.
Up there in Jersey, a lot of those little cottage towns like you're talking about,
they condemn them.
Took them over.
They're just
gone. You can't build back there.
that it was a buyout.
Yep.
It's interesting. I mean, it's...
Yes, ma'am.
There is an online coastal report that I monitor with some regularity, and what I keep finding is that there are places all over the world right now, but especially, I mean, I focus on the United States coastlines, and what I see with most of them is that they're struggling with the same problem, not that they've found many answers. But I'd love to see whatever that is that was circulating.
It was a magazine article. It was from Vanity Fair.
The name is Coast to Toast, or Sea Level Rise, Coast to Toast.
It was just an interesting help. These communities are struggling with the same issues.
Same issue. Thank you.
The whole country is struggling with this issue. Yeah. Okay, well, I think I have enough to try and put together something for us to look at the next time.
I just wanted to make one suggestion, is that in some cases, I think we should make definite suggestions or requirements where they've had damages, in particular if they have consistent damages. There are others we know that could be in danger, and it could be a lot of properties in Dewey Beach, that perhaps we need to make recommendations, but not quite so strong. In other words, we strongly recommend you raise your house up, but you're an area where we're not requiring it at this time. So there's an option as well for consideration, that's all.
I mean, I think it's clear that we need to deal with this in the comprehensive plan. I mean, this whole floodplain management issue is...
It's got to be in there.
We don't even know if what properties have had FEMA damage reimbursement. And we probably ought to have some sort of a mechanism that we know who's, you know, what is being claimed here, so we have an idea of what the losses are.
Yeah. And some of them that have damage, the flood insurance has said you have to go up.
Okay.
We won't insure you anymore unless you do this. So.
Yeah.
I agree. There needs to be some type of documentation of what's going on here in town. You know, who's getting the losses. And
they send out, FEMA sends out a once-a-year report on all repetitive losses in this area. And they send it out, like I said, after Sandy, they would send it out for people that make claims. And then they also, the repetitive loss is accumulated, and it's a like a 10-year period or an 8-year period is what they do. And that's what they also base the repetitive loss on. The accumulation of years, not just one event.
Yeah. I know when I flood insurance, and you get a report every year, tells you what, if any, claims have been made against that. So there ought to be a provision that we can somehow, if they give it, when they give it to you, Bill, do they give it to you by property?
No, it comes for the whole town. Each property from the whole town is listed separately.
It is listed separately, and the damages for property?
Well, values, don't tell you what.
Yeah.
It just said what insurance claims they've had.
Okay. Well, that would be
a good thing.
Flood insurance only.
No, they also give wind and stuff like that.
Okay.
I mean, it's separated. It tells you what it's for. But it's not... It's for the repetitive losses in, FEMA areas. But it's not just flood.
Okay.
There's wind damage, too.
Is that just provided that you have insurance?
Huh?
Is that only if you have insurance that damage? You have to get reported.
Right.
So uninsured losses are not reported on that?
Right. It's only for insurance claims. That's all.
Okay.
Continue on the four.
Okay, number four. Number four deals with section 185.59, damage or destruction of non-conforming use or building. 185.59 currently reads, if a non-conforming building is damaged by fire, storm, infestation, or other peril not caused intentionally by the property owner, it may be repaired or reconstructed to essentially the same configuration as existed prior to the damage, provided that any repair or reconstruction must be completed within 1 year and 6 months of the date of the damage. If a different configuration or an expansion of the original building is proposed, it must conform to all applicable regulations, including all applicable setbacks, height, and elevation requirements. So if you were to read this, you might think that if your property were in a flood zone and was substantially damaged by flood, that you could rebuild to the same configuration, which is in conflict with the requirement from FEMA that you must build to FEMA plus one. So this is kind of the corollary or inverse of what we've been discussing. And so the recommendation or the suggestion is that we amend this by adding a language that essentially would require elevation or relocation of such a structure being rebuilt to meet with FEMA guidelines or FEMA plus town guidelines. And so there's two suggestions that it be, A, except that any non-conforming building located in a coastal floodplain area that is substantially damaged due to flooding shall not be permitted to be repaired or reconstructed except in a location and or manner so as to be in compliance with all town and FEMA slash National Flood Insurance Program requirements to mitigate against future flood loss. And B, if a building which does not conform to all setback requirements sustains substantial flood loss and cannot be moved to a different location on the same property and or repaired or reconstructed so as to be compliant with town setbacks and town FEMA and NFIP base elevation requirements, then, and we put in the 185-60B or whatever it was, the thing, the requirements that we just talked about. I mean, basically, this removes an ambiguity in the code. The code saying if you have a loss, you can rebuild, but if you're in a floodplain and have a substantial loss, you have to elevate, so it's not the same configuration. I think it's a fairly benign
change. I mean, as long as we're cognizant, the only change we would be permitting is for flooding, not for fire or infestation of, you know, termite infestation. Because it's only, the only change we would permit to the existing code would be for people in the floodplain and storm.
Well, actually, so, but that's a good point because, I mean, if, so.
I mean, that's the way it reads.
Yeah. Right, but Bill, so if my house is in the floodplain and it burns down and I rebuild, I have to build the FEMA plus one? So then,
it would have to
so this has to be everything.
This has to be amended, so it would be more than that. That is
so, so, but it would be amended to say that if you are in a floodplain and have any of these, then you can't build to the same configuration. You have to build to the FEMA requirements. Right. And, you know, it may say that someplace else in the code, like floodplain, the floodplain management section, chapter 101. This is to, no, that's a good
right.
point.
So I think we would have to say, yes, you can do that.
Yeah. There's one other thing in that first paragraph that kind of like bothers me. It says it needs to be completed within 1 year and 6 months. That seems awful tight. Maybe it should be started within a year or something like that. Because, I mean, completion in a year and a half? That's
well, your building code's good for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
A year plus a year.
Well, that's you get a year extension, yeah.
Yeah.
I just thought it seemed
I don't know why it's
tight.
A year and a half.
I think it's a short period of time, too.
Well, especially if you need to negotiate with your insurance carrier
think about what happened.
The word completed to start.
Follow what Chuck said. There are homes still that they can't get contractors up here to build. They're swamped with homes that need to be redone. So maybe.
I mean, we
could do that with a 1 year extension upon request or something like that.
You know, we're coming up on a year anniversary of Sandy.
Yeah.
We're still rebuilding.
Yeah.
And we will continue to rebuild.
Yeah. So what's
or
the right?
Maybe more months.
So what's the right thing?
So that's a year and a half. And we've got some of the stuff that we may not get to until next year.
I assume.
So I think a year and a half, while it might be okay for a residential property.
Yeah. Now would start.
Business, that's totally
different. Would start in a year and a half be more appropriate? I assume that there's language here to keep you from.
I would say so.
Yeah, not taking any action at all.
Change the word completed to started, and that takes care of it.
Bill, when we talk about having to build to FEMA standards, as far as height,
right?
Is that only because of insurance?
Basically, yes.
Yeah. I mean, if I have an uninsured property,
well, no.
Do I have to build to FEMA standards?
Well, anything in a flood zone, FEMA is requiring you to build. And I know what you're saying. People have been asking me, if you don't have a mortgage on a place, why do I have to...
If I don't have a mortgage, I don't have insurance.
Yeah. Why? But no, FEMA still requires you to rebuild to their standards.
You have to, because Dewey is a community that has signed on to FEMA's insurance subsidies.
Right.
And in order to get subsidies for the people who need them, the whole town has to comply.
Right. Right.
Okay.
Right. One thing about, you know, your concern about the year and a half, maybe you have a year and a half to apply for a building permit, and then once that building permit is issued, you know, it falls under the stipulations of the building permit completion, and then he can, you know, continue giving extensions that way. So you have a year and a half to apply for a building permit, and then afterwards, you know, you negotiate with the building inspector. As to the building inspector can see, well, you made a non-start, you're having problems getting a contractor in, whatever material, then he can grant extensions, which I think most building inspectors do, you know, very, very, very often.
I'm fine with that. Any way you get it done that doesn't lock the person in.
There's a lot of problems in construction sites that, you know, delay, and then buildings, as long as the building inspector knows you have an earnest attempt that you're working on, right, he has the right to extend it.
Yeah, I think the intent here is to, a property that sits damaged for 5 years is now not allowed to, you know, be, you know, with these provisions. But somebody that's earnestly looking to construct the property, you know, reconstruct the building, I think everybody's happy with that. It's just the abandoned or neglected property that is the concern here. I think that's why the year and a half requirement is there. I mean, otherwise.
Well, you ought to have some insight in it, otherwise.
Right.
This would be completely open-ended.
Well, how long are building permits issued for, Bill? How long are building permits issued for? What's the limit?
1 year.
1 year?
And then you have a 1 year renewal.
Then you have automatic 1 year renewal.
You can, yes.
You can, so mm-hmm. Pretty much 2 years to get it rebuilt.
You have to ask for the occupancy after 2 years, or after 1 year, and then after 2 years. In other words, this is not starting construction. It's completely.
Then you have to ask for an extension after 2 year period,
and that's completion of construction.
Right. And then you have to go back after that, like starting all over again, after 2 years.
I see. So.
Bill, do we have many properties that have gone beyond that time frame?
Only two that I can remember.
It's really not a major issue then.
Mm-hmm.
So we're doing the apply for building permit in a year and a half?
That's what I would like to say.
It may take a while to get all your insurance and everything else. It may take a while to figure it all out. So.
Okay.
Customer friendly.
Number five. So this has to do with basically a prohibition in the town code for expanding or enlarging a property that is in an area that is inundated. And so 101.15, existing structures in coastal floodplain areas, which are the AE and VE zones. It says, structures existing in any coastal floodplain area prior to the enactment of this chapter, but which are not in compliance with these provisions, may continue to remain subject to the following. A, within the coastal high hazard area, which is the VE zone, where there is high velocity wave action, existing structures located seaward of the mean, of the reach of mean high tide shall not be expanded or enlarged. Now, I mean, one issue is that we, with the new proposed flood insurance risk map, we have a VE zone on the bayside. So do we want to add mirroring language to include that you can't build channelward of mean high tide? Because we now have properties on the bayside in a VE zone. So this basically says if you're in a VE zone and mean high tide overruns your property, you can't build or expand, you can't, what does it say? You can't enlarge or expand your structure if you get flooded.
So the trigger is you're underwater.
That's at high tide.
Okay.
I don't think you can lump in because if you are on the ocean side, you're restricted by the dune lines, then there's a dune line where you can build. And that high tide nowhere reaches the dune line. So the possibility of having to enforce that on the ocean side is not there ever. Because of
today,
the dynamic.
Because we have the dunes.
Well, by your point, not really have the dunes. You have a theoretical dune line. If the dunes get washed out, Denrec can come back and enforce that dune line. It's on Delaware State Plain Coordinate Systems and say, okay, this is the line you can't go past.
Right.
See, now they do have their provisions there too.
I see this as being more comprehensive than that. I mean, when we didn't have dunes, and water washed over the dunes from time to time, but that's not mean high tide.
That's not high tide.
But I see this not only moving, building your property forward beyond the building line, but building the second floor, building the third floor, building a garage in the rear. I mean, it says expand or enlarge, which I
can see discussing it in some detail regarding the bay, but as far as the ocean, I don't know why you would even get into that.
It's in the code currently about the ocean.
Okay.
The only with the exception of the underlined or channel ward, this is the existing language in the floodplain management section 101.15.
I understand that, but maybe we should make the change now or think about making the change.
You know, and I wasn't being bold enough to suggest we remove seaward because you never know what's going to happen with the dunes and stuff. I mean, if the dunes disappear and nobody rebuilds them, then, you know, there could be a problem with that. I think here the issue is if a structure is inundated on a regular basis, why would we want to let somebody expand it or enlarge it?
I don't think you would, but...
But you can do that currently in the code.
You can do that in code now?
If you're a channel ward.
If you're in the VE zone on the bayside, we never had a VE zone on the
bayside.
Well,
we still do because this is a preliminary map.
Well, I know, but I assume that, you know.
And they can change their minds by the time
it's
made official. So we're trying to enact an ordinance for something that's not really off record yet. We don't have a VE zone on the bayside.
We don't. I just see it coming and put this here. Well, I'm willing to table this discussion until...
The property line, or the town limit line, is based on the tidal water. As the tide comes up, is Denrec going to have jurisdiction in those areas that you're now talking about?
That's a good one. The state of Delaware is a high tide line states. Navigable waters, the state of Delaware claims they own up to the mean high tide navigable water. So that was the there's lots of old subdivision plans that were recorded years and years ago that if you look at their fee simple lines, it goes out into navigable waters, whether it's the bay or a river. Not anymore. You don't own that anymore. The state now owns that land to the mean high tide. and it's arbitrary, changes, you know, as the years go by. So you can't build. And actually, that mean high tide line is your property line. So any setbacks, if that's your side yard, your rear yard, whatever it's considered, you can't build within that setback line. So it's already basically your zoning code. Let's just say along the bay, let's say along, you have property along the bay where it is, and you know, you, that is your side yard, I'm just saying, for whatever zoning, let's say 10 feet, 12 feet. He can't build within 10 or 12 feet of the mean high water already because that's his property line. The state owns to that. Now, you could enact a larger buffer if you want for environmental reasons or aesthetic reasons to prevent him from building there. But you know, by your building setback lines, you already have established how far any improvements can go there. Second floors, additions, or anything. Unless you build an accessory structure, which...
Right, right. You know, so the existing property lines or the bay could very well have changed already.
Right.
Based upon high tides.
They change regularly.
Yeah. So their property is constantly...
It's a meandering line.
So, yeah. But yeah. We're talking about a property that is... Well, and of the mean high tide. So this guy's underwater.
He doesn't own anything. He doesn't own that property.
He doesn't own the property anymore.
So should we modify this to address reality?
I mean, if you want to take that on at this time, or you want to bring it up now.
I don't think we need to do anything with this except put an X through it. Because it's under the jurisdiction of DNR.
Exactly. And you know, that's DNR, right?
So do we
it's
want...
It's not our jurisdiction. It's not the town's jurisdiction. If it's under that water, it's out of the town.
And the town has already established setback lines for property lines, whether it's your side yard or your rear yard. I can't imagine it would be your front yard, but you've already established a setback line, how close you can build to that mean high water, which is your property line.
So what's the deal with the case in Silver Lake?
From what I understand, I wasn't following it closely until recently. That was one of those... That's one of those old subdivisions that show fee simple subdivision lines going into the body of water, extending from high land into the water.
And, so was the problem that Denrick, that the state didn't claim ownership of
it was,
that
it was,
land?
It was a gray area at that time who owned it, and now I think Denrick has made
Denrick
a decision.
Has decided that they own it.
So what I think we're trying to do, we're saying, well, my property goes out here, I can keep on building as far as I want, because I own 20 feet out into the lake. And that's where the issue, that's where that whole issue came up, and then they said, okay, you can't build within 10 feet of the
lake. So on the bay side of Dewey, the state owns up to the mean high tide?
Yes.
And so that's, I don't think people realize that, but...
Some people probably don't, but that's, you know, that's the law. In Maryland, it's low tide.
So do we want to...
They've taken over, they agreed to take over Lake Hamagi.
Yeah. I think it was a gray area on those lakes. The landowners can fight that. They want to line up their lawyers and pay, you know, to fight the Attorney General's office. They can argue that.
And so successful.
So do we want to do nothing with this at this time, or do we want to recommend that this subsection be deleted?
I recommend it be deleted. As far as like trying to deal with the baseline.
Well, you know, this whole thing, all of our, the existing code that we have is going to be reviewed by Denrick anyway, for the FEMA. And Mike Carlson, whenever he decides to come down here for a workshop with us.
So do nothing at this point?
Would we want to offer some instruction in this code? Tell people just what Mike has told us, you know? I mean, is this the place to...
No, I don't think so. A person who's buying property normally would get a survey, and an accurate survey would represent that, and they would know it then. People who own property there probably have had the wrath of Denrick brought on them already. They know what's going on.
Okay.
Then take it out.
Well, right now it doesn't deal with the bayside; it just deals seaward.
Established. Yeah. They've got a dune line from Fenwick all the way up to
okay. So just take it out. Number six has to do with how we define substantial improvement. And currently, there are, I think in the code, there are several definitions of substantial improvement. And it's used in some places where it's not clear. But in Chapter 101, in the definitions, it's a cumulative total of 50% of the market value of the structure prior to damage over a 10-year period. And in other places in the code, it is 50% of the pre-existing value of the structure with no qualifier as to whether that's a single event or 10 years. And so the thought here was to do two things, to clarify in all of the code what the meaning of substantial damage is, if it's going to be 50% over 10 years, to just make that clear all across the board. And then a thought that, again, in terms of improving resilience in the face of sea level rise, if we're providing provisions, relaxations of the code to allow people at risk or people who have suffered damage to take advantages of those relaxations to lower the definition of substantial damage. So if you had 30%, then you could avail yourself of the relief rather than 50% in a single event. It's not clear we've decided to move forward in any of those cases.
I guess the difference being, why would we want to change 50% to 30%? What would be the basis for that as a discussion?
Well, if you're going to, for example, let somebody elevate their non-conforming with regard to setbacks, if you're going to allow them to elevate to FEMA if they have substantial damage that exceeds 50%, might we want to provide that to the first-time flood damage person who's only seen a 30% damage? Rather than waiting for the next storm to come along in 2 years and do another 30% and then let him elevate his property. And again, this is something we could discuss down the road. It's not clear to me with regard to things that we've pushed forward and decided not.
It could even be a moot issue, because if the person can't build to a FEMA standard, even if it's 10%, they may not be able to build based on where the damage is.
Yeah, I believe the FEMA requirement is when it is 50%. Cumulative over 10 years reaches 50%, they have to elevate it. So if you had a 40% loss, you don't have to build to meet FEMA.
I got you. So
right, Bill?
Right.
Now, if you have if you have a 15% loss the next year or 10 years later, you have to build to FEMA standards. But the first time, it's at 50. So you could rebuild with a 40% loss without meeting FEMA guidelines. And the question is, would we want to change this number to let somebody then take advantage of...
I hear what you're saying. It makes some sense. The question is, for a homeowner, you have to put in your mind, do I want to risk this? Do I want to build below FEMA standards the first time versus the FEMA standards? What's the tipping point? Because if I get another storm and it's only 10%, I probably wouldn't even make a claim to FEMA if I had to raise the house to go to FEMA standards. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah, you might be able to game the system, but
No, I don't know that you'd be gaining it. I think you'd be caught.
Well, you'd be caught because you would spend the 40%.
You'd be big, big time caught.
You know, you'd spend the 40% to rebuild as is, and then you'd only get a 10%, and you've got a...
And, you know, the 10% may be substantial to somebody and say, I can't...
I lost my way a little bit here, but if a person has a low-lying, below FEMA standards in the floodplain, and they're proactive and they say they want to raise it 3 feet or 5 feet or 1 foot above FEMA, they're allowed to do that.
Provided they're not encroaching side yard setbacks.
Okay, but if they're not conforming because of encroachments, they're not allowed to do that.
Correct.
Unless they have the damage.
That's correct.
Unless...
Okay.
There's a community on the Delaware Bay, halfway up the state, basically it's called, and Mike Powell, who put the presentation, mm-hmm. he's one of the players in all this, and my company is because we're providing technical information. There's a dozen or so houses that have applied for grants that are being raised, and none of them comply to setbacks, right. And they're just allowing them to raise it up and put it back down. Some of them should be torn down. I can't imagine they're doing it, but they're allowing them to do it. That's just for your information. And that's in Newcastle County. And it's a community that comes under Newcastle County's zoning regulations.
Well, I think we decided...
Right. Just to the FEMA standard.
Yeah, they're right on the bay. They're right on the Delaware Bay. And
Literally,
you know, some of them...
Well,
They're getting some kind of grant money. And there's a lot of people involved. And I was in a conference call the other day with them, and basically they're just raising them up, putting them in.
Well, I think we decided...
Above the 100-year elevation.
I think we decided earlier that if you have more than 50% damage, that we will provide that relief in doing.
Why do you have to wait till you have damage? First of all, you get some grant money, or they want to cash in their IRAs, I want to raise my house.
This is properties that encroach in the setbacks.
I understand, but right. They're not. This is a scenario. Other than encroaching in the setbacks, they're not risking any danger to life or anything. You know,
and
they're encroaching. But if they are looking forward and saying, "Okay, I want to get above this storm. I want to raise my house."
I agree with what you're saying.
And I'm going to continue encroaching. I'm just going to raise it. You're not going to allow them to do that.
We don't allow them to do that, as I read the code.
Well, that was one of the discussions we started off
earlier.
With, is wouldn't we want them to be able to be proactive if they choose to do so?
I thought I wasn't clear on thinking earlier, but it's coming clear to me now. That,
Thank you, Mike. You were the one who objected at that point.
I did?
You had some concerns. I think Dale had some concerns about opening up, had to do with, from non-conformity.
What I indicated was that naturally, codes are intended to bring people up to conformity,
right.
Not to allow them to
right.
indefinitely continue non-conform. That's what national codes do. And if you want to go in a different direction, that's right. But you've got to understand that you'd be going against it.
I think I took myself out of context. what I was thinking about the house is damaged, where it should be torn down, and can be replaced according to setbacks. If not, then allow them to
and
be replaced.
We said if they had more than 50%, they could. Okay. Encroaching in a flood zone, encroaching in the setbacks, can't move to not encroach in the setbacks, more than 50% damage, we're going to let them elevate. And if you change this from 50% to 30%, you would open the door a little Alan's going to say how many properties are we talking about, we don't know.
So I guess I'm getting confused when we say encroach into the FEMA setbacks.
No,
because we're not,
it's the town setbacks.
Yeah, because we're not encroaching in FEMA.
No, it's encroaching in the town setbacks.
So the record is straight from me. My opinion is if somebody is encroaching setbacks, but yet they want to raise their house above the 100-year floodplain, I'd like to go on record to say that they can raise that house and put the footprint right back down where they were.
I agree. Yeah.
If in fact the house is destroyed or should be destroyed, then, and if it's a buildable lot, then it should build according to setbacks.
Right.
If it's not a buildable lot, or the character, or they want to prove to us in the Board of Adjustment that it won't meet the character of the block, then they can come in and appeal to allow them to continue the character of the block and, you know, leave it up to the Planning Commission and Board for the Adjustment.
Why would, let's argue, why wouldn't we want to do this? What would be the fallback here?
I'm all for it.
I mean, is there a bad side to
it? I mean, the only negative side to it is when you think about the neighbor's view. I mean, I can't think of another thing, and I don't know if we should be paying that much attention to that, you know?
I don't think you can.
You can't, really.
I mean, somebody can say, if he goes up 1 foot, he's killed my view. I mean,
you can do that now with regular construction.
I'm not disagreeing with you.
Yeah. The only areas I've ever seen that done is waterfront communities where they put an architectural restriction in the deeds that if you have a waterfront lot, you can only build a one-story house so that the people on the hill behind you still have a water view. I've seen that in many places. But as far as if you're in a town and you've got a waterfront view now, buyer beware, it might be gone someday because somebody in front of you is building according to code and will block your view.
And that's true. That's right.
And right now they can't do that. So, you know, it's, they can't.
They can if it's a conforming lot.
They can if I mean, again, it only gets into these issues of properties that encroach in the town's setbacks that can't be moved within the lot to not encroach in the setbacks, which now can't be elevated up, but we're discussing elevating that. Do we want to go back to number three?
I think that's a different character or a different situation that definitely has to go before the Board of Adjustment.
You know, I think philosophy, it seems to me, for the planning process, we ought to be looking at the greater public good. And is this good for Dewey Beach rather than the individual here and there? And I think we're on the right track of doing what we think is good for the entire town. You know, if somebody wants to block a permit from being rebuilt, they can take it to the Board of Adjustments and let them haggle it there. But it seems to me this is the right way to approach.
And just to reiterate, you think the right way to approach it is to allow people that have non-conforming properties to be proactive and to be able to build?
It's not quite, no insurance company, no federal dollars, that's their own money.
Well, it might be federal.
Sure.
Well, if they can get a grant, I mean, that's great, but I'm just saying, why would we not want them to do that? Do we want a disaster to happen first and risk life and limb potentially of somebody and have major property damage and have 2 years of
mess? I sense that there is a change in the consensus of the commission on this issue.
I mean, I'm sensitive to what you said. I mean, I agree with it. I think I express that point of view and so forth, and it's consistent with what Dale's talking about. That is bringing everything into conformance eventually. But I think that's the decision. I think that's consistent with what some of the commissioners have espoused. That is to maintain the quality and characteristics of the community. And you know that means that these 20 or 50 or 100 non-conforming properties need to be here 10 or 20 years from now, and there needs to be a path forward for the owners to invest in them and to enjoy them.
Right.
So, and if they're proactive, they put in $100,000 to raise the property, more power to the town and to the people. I mean, that's kind of I think that's, you know, sympathetic with the community. I think that's a community point of view.
I would think.
Ellen?
I am so impressed with the work you've done, the complexity of this thing, and what I realize is you're kind of setting this whole thing up philosophically, the kind of town, the kind of atmosphere. Would it make any difference to have an interim report to the commissioners to get confirmation that that's the code that they want? Usually a working committee waits until you're all finished, you've made all the decisions, you may even have an ordinance. You've put a huge amount of work in, and there's so many times today that it's come up, well, but we want to have this kind of an approach to the citizens, well, but we want this kind of a town. And I just wonder if you had a brief interim report where you say, this is how we're going with this code. is this the direction you want? Do you want the code to now create this benevolent atmosphere for these people with flooding issues? Does that save you anything or assure you that any future work has very good odds of getting approved because you and the commissioners are on the same page? It sounds like to me you are. But I just wonder if some of the other committees were talking about interim reports rather than waiting until all the work is done. Would that be of any assurance or help to you if you...
The short answer, as far as I'm concerned, if it prevents our members from wasting their time, yes,
yes.
Definitely.
It might.
I think it's a good. I'm sorry. I think it's a good suggestion for two reasons, not only for the reason Alan mentions, but there are very few people here today. And as you know, all of you know, it seems that no one says a darn thing until it comes to the commissioners, and then everything hits the fan. So if we put it on the town council agenda for you to do an update and to bring some of your questions on, you know, what philosophy should we be following in this, that you not only get some commissioners but some public input that can help you move forward in a more productive and...
I think it sounds like a positive idea. Yeah, it really does. We should try and do that.
I would even go a step further and ask for a joint workshop between the commissioners and the planning commission,
mm-hmm.
just to focus on just a couple of areas.
Okay.
Because that would guarantee we would get public care.
Yeah. You're kind of talking about the personality of the town. You're
right.
talking about how rigid or benevolent mm-hmm. or legal-minded it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like something we could work on together. I'm for saving you time, effort, whatever, because I'm just overwhelmed by the quality of the work and the quality of the discussion that you have here today. You all are to be commended. You've really done a great job. And most people, including myself, have no clue it's this complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And how the individual property owner will be affected.
Well, this is our third or fourth
third.
Meeting on this. And so we've been on it a little while. So
okay, we can do that. We can work on something.
I think that's a great idea. Thank you, Mrs. Danaher. Appreciate that one. It's good thinking.
If we can go back to this B for just a second.
6B?
Yes, 6B. I think I'd be opposed to reducing the 50% down to one-third.
And the reason being, what's your rationale?
Well, and maybe I'm not reading this right, but does this mean that if I have one-third damage, I must comply, or I must go?
Yes.
Okay. I'm right now to 50. On a $200,000 or $300,000 piece of property, that's quite a substantial sum. You know, in between here, between one third and 50%. I just don't really see the need.
So then the other question would be 50% versus a cumulative 50% over 10-year period.
Isn't that what that...
Yeah. Well, it currently says 50%. Other areas of the code, including the definitions of 101, define substantial damage as 50%, or cumulative 50% over a 10-year period.
Isn't that going to be addressed by FEMA anyway?
Well, but this is...
I mean, they're going to address that whole issue of repetitive loss. And they may define it for us over a certain period
of time.
Well,
I believe that, I mean, so again, this deals with existing structures and floodplains.
Right.
And FEMA will require a cumulative damage of 50%. You have to build to FEMA standards, period.
I mean, I guess I look at this, I think we're splitting hairs here because the current code says 50% or more, and we're looking to possibly consider a one-third market value or more. And I think in these assessments, I mean, if somebody comes into a property and looks at the damage and they say, well, it's going to cost $150,000 for what was assessed to be a $300,000 property, you know, another assessor can come in and say it's going to cost $100,000 for a $400,000 property with my assessments. And, you know, the difference between 30% and 50% blurs in this process of getting these estimates or these numbers to the insurance company. So
right.
We're splitting hairs when we're trying to make the difference between 50% and 30%.
Okay. So the other question, the other part of this question is, do we go from 50%? So what it says currently is 50%,
yeah,
or more. Our code defines substantial damage as a cumulative 50% over 10 years, and FEMA requires you to build to FEMA standards if you're 50% over 10 years. So do we want to bring this in compliance with FEMA standards? I suspect that Mike Powell is going to require us to do that, that the state's going to require us to do that.
That would at least be, you know, bringing some consistency so people that read the code don't get confused as to what's Dewey Beach and what's FEMA. They don't be the same. That would have some benefit. I think that's a possibility.
I have a FEMA summary of coverage recordings, and it says replacement cost value. It says, first of all, your building must be a single-family dwelling, and the building must be your principal residence at the time of loss, meaning you lived there at least 80% of the year.
Mm.
And your building coverage is at least 80% of the full replacement cost of the building, or is the maximum available for the property under the FIP. That probably adds to the confusion a little more.
Yeah.
So most of Dewey Beach doesn't fall within the domain.
Doesn't fall.
Well, they're not living there all the time.
Right.
Yeah. I honestly don't know the answer to that. I mean, this was sent to me. I've got three properties. Yeah. I have flood insurance on that. I didn't pay much attention except pay the bills. And also, you only have coverage for up to $250,000 in personal property. You can get up to $100,000.
Up to the first floor.
Pardon?
Including up to the first floor. That's all it covers.
Well, $250,000.
I think if we've lowered, I can see the point that if you don't have insurance and you run into it and you decide you want to build, I mean, then you got to build to a certain standard. You may be able to cover it. You might want to wait to the 50% before you go to the FEMA standards. You know, for anybody that doesn't want to go. But I think it's mixing hairs at this point. If the state and FEMA is going to say 50% or 80%, whatever it is, I think we should meet the same standard.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, do you want to do the last two quickly, maybe, or do you want to push these off to? Item 7 is. We currently prohibit, in 185.20, we currently prohibit littering, dumping, and discharge in ditches, storm sewers, bays, and the lakes. I'm sorry. Now, let me see what this actually says. It's, so, currently 185.20, sewage or wastewater holding tanks. Holding tanks for sewage or wastewater are prohibited in all districts. And the question was whether we wanted to prohibit littering, dumping, and discharges in ditches, storm sewers, bay, and lakes, and the ocean under an expanded 185.20.
What is 185.20? It's not zoning, is it?
Oh, yeah, it is zoning.
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay. You haven't got a book yet, have you?
I'm downloading off the internet the best I can, and it's just not all the guys are on.
Yeah. Now, 185.20 just says holding tanks for sewage or wastewater are prohibited in the districts. We don't actually have a prohibition that I could find on prohibiting littering, dumping, discharges in ditches, storm sewers, bays, the lakes, and the ocean. We used to have something that recommended that you throw your dog waste in the storm sewers. And in the spirit of, sea level rise, bay level rise, reducing discharge into these, providing cleaner water discharge into these, this seemed like a reasonable change to make.
The reason I asked that was because if you were to enforce that and find somebody, then you'd have under the jurisdiction of zoning to bring them into a civil court. If you catch somebody littering and doing that, is that...
Yeah, we've already got a littering ordinance.
Well, this is...
I mean, to enforce it and to actually find somebody for doing it. Is that a zoning thing that you would take them to court and find them on, or is that a civil action that you can arrest them and bring them in?
The littering, I believe, it's a fine. It's a civil fine.
Well, but Mike's question, I mean, is a good question. Would... dumping into the storm sewer, is that should that be covered under civil?
Could be. That would be a legal question, but if it seemed to be any illegal dumping or anything like that, we probably already have something in the code that addresses that.
Goes on right now.
So that's good. So the last one on the list of things to do today would be to discuss waiving or reducing building permit fees for new and retrofit projects that improve resilience to sea level rise or for repairs following substantial flood damage.
I would agree with that. I don't think we should waive it. I think we should reduce it. You know, I think there should still be...
what's our building? It's a 3%, isn't it, Bill?
Make it something nominal. I mean, what is the cost of... I mean, what is the building permit? I mean, what...
Well, they vary.
What's it cost you? I mean, in time. Yeah.
It varies. It's all for making out the estimates and giving them to you.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's also a way to evaluate all, retrofitting or reconstruction or something. Everybody has their own way of evaluating, for permits. And the actual cost, I would think, would be based on insurance estimates. And that's how they, a lot of FEMA figures retrofitting or rebuilding on what insurance companies estimate, for repairing situations like that.
Do you have a sense for what is your average amount of time that you spend on a building permit? I mean,
we mean average amount of time.
I mean,
when you review the plan,
it's all according to what you're doing.
Yeah. So it's a wide variety. I'm just thinking, if we're going to reduce the fee, what would we reduce it to? What would 1%, 0.5%?
I mean, 1.5%.
Cut it in half.
Mm-hmm. Because still, I'm telling you, I have estimates come in for work so ridiculous, it's unbelievable that people do. And that's what I say. I can go and on an average job, go back to say it's an insurance job, and I can tell that the person is using actual insurance figures or they're using makeshift figures so they don't have to deal with a large building permit.
I'll be happy. Before we jump into reduce, let me find out what the other towns and do we do. I'll be happy to make some calls. Just to see what everybody else is doing before we jump in and make it around.
We have a consensus that we should make this easy for people, I think.
Well, in that way, the town doesn't necessarily need to benefit from
somebody else's.
I could see if somebody has a loss of property, a substantial loss, and he has to go back with FEMA, I could say charge nothing. I mean, they've lost their home, they've got enough headache, and then just let it go. But I would if you all give me time, I understand where it is. Let me just see what everybody else is doing.
That's fine.
And I'll report back.
I think what Bill was describing, as I understood it, was that people will give you a reduced estimate of cost. In other words, it's a $200,000 job, but they'll show you a $100,000 estimate. Is that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I get it every day. $3,000 instead of $6,000. I'm talking about not just on something of this nature. I'm talking about people doing additions and stuff like that. That and then
sure.
Okay. I can see, you know, what they're doing. And they're trying to eliminate a building permit fee. Is what they're trying to do.
In a million different ways, probably.
Yeah. And you know about and some of them.
I can tell you.
Okay, so are we going to...
I think we're good for the
we're
day.
Good. So do we want to entertain a date and time of another the next meeting?
We did respond to the suggestion that we might have a report to the commissioners. I don't know if we're prepared to do that in the next month or 2 months, or whether we want to have the next meeting before. Maybe the next meeting we plan to prepare that statement.
I was going to make an effort to do the minutes of this meeting prior to the meeting on the 12th and provide that to Harry. And I mean, in the past, the chair has made these kinds of reports to the commissioners as a report what's come out of the meetings.
Yeah, I think Mr. Wilson can make a report at any commissioner meeting. That would be fine with me. If you were to try to summarize what we were talking about, that'd be good.
I would. I'd have no problem, but the typical thing is when we get an item completed is when we do that. And normally it's one meeting, one item is complete, you know. So, yeah, that's what it's been in the past, but we haven't done anything with this because it's been a series, you know, and we're forming our consensus now. But, yeah, we can... Sure.
Let's try the next meeting, but I was trying to get a sense of what the structure might be for this interim report. Suggested that we might give to the commissioners.
I'm thinking it should be a regular agenda item, not just a report, because that if you just give a report, then it doesn't give us the same freedom to discuss and possibly vote.
That's a good point.
So I think it should be a regular agenda item. The other reason we need for an agenda item that gets attention to it.
Yeah,
and if people hear more work, it's just a report from Planning Commission. They may not pick up on that and come.
Right. Yeah, be a little more formal.
So do we feel like we need one more meeting before we offer this report?
I'm not sure. Not necessarily. I don't know.
Well, I mean, there's no time to notice it.
Yes.
Well, for the October meeting. I mean, there's no. If you wanted to do it for the November meeting, then...
We would just have a summary of our discussions because we don't have any formal vote at this point.
No, we haven't.
We just have a consensus.
And some of the issues.
We wouldn't want the commissioners to vote on our consensus because we're not there.
Well, we want to hear...
But we would look for feedback.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't know whether we would need to vote either, but if you're asking, should we be more amenable to helping people, whether we want to be hard-nosed... You know, I don't think we need to vote on that.
No, consensus, are we on the right?
But it would help if the commissioners gave us a nod that yes, well, you're going in the right direction.
Yeah.
Keep on track. Or red flag, we think you might be going in the wrong direction. You know.
Well,
the other thing, if the agenda item is, worded in a way that the property owners who are affected by this know this is going to be discussed. Some of those affected may show up in a meeting and have comment that maybe we hadn't thought of or something. Mm-hmm. So also, the more you can educate the commissioners where they're making a knowledgeable decision, that's a real contribution.
And for the record, our August the 24th meeting did have was well attended and had people who were affected by sea level rise in attendance there. And so we did well in that one.
Harry, what might work is for you to make a report to the commissioners at the meeting on October 12th and for the commissioners to decide based on that report to hold a joint workshop in November to discuss these issues. And then, you know, I assume the answer is yes, and then you would set aside a couple of hours, not at a town meeting, and as was done in the past on the budget, and, you know, send a letter out to the property owners in the flood zones or something.
And I agree, and I think it's important to do it because once you get past mid-November, you're into the holidays, then you're into the cold months, you're not going to have many people here from mid-November through mid-March almost, or at least mid-February. So if you want to move forward with that, I think that's a good suggestion. Make a preliminary report at the next meeting. We can set up, hopefully, a date for us all to get together sometime before now, mid-November.
So but that the October 12th meeting would not be an agenda item. It would just be a simple report.
No, because
it could be an agenda item from the standpoint of reviewing and discussing preliminary recommendations and setting up a possible workshop date.
Yeah. You know, it might also give us an opportunity to invite Denrick, and we may have something at the workshop if we have that, so we can include them in.
The other thing is, it would be good for all of you to probably attend, if you can, the October meeting, because I think, well, I have to know for sure that they can make it, but I want to have the master plan presented by the infrastructure committee, and I think it would be good for the planning commission to hear that. So I don't know whether that'll be at the meeting, whether they can make it October 12th, or whether it might be some other special day out.
I can certainly find out. I mean, you know, do you want somebody at the October 12th meeting, or the?
Well, I said what I'm trying to figure out is I don't know whether the infrastructure committee can make it October 12th or not yet.
I think it's a good idea, because.
But if they can, and they come to the October 12th meeting to give their report, it would be good if some of you could be there. If they can't make it then and we set up another date, then maybe that could be even combined with this whole workshop I'm trying to.
Well, okay. I guess what has come to my mind is that for your meeting, since this is a zoning matter, it needs to be advertised 2 weeks, and you don't have that. You don't have enough time.
To be an agenda
item at the 12th.
If it's just a report, you could do it.
If it's just a report, it would. But to make it an agenda item, I think you guys might be.
Changes, but,
yeah. Is there any way you can advertise the meeting, but not as an agenda item? Is there any way that the word could get out, either on the website or through all the town groups, email blasts, and let that.
Just call it an update.
And stress
on the board. You know, maybe, and you can slap me later, Mayor, is that maybe this ought to be one of the first items on the, have the report first.
Yeah. Yeah, so people will come.
This way people will stay and listen to what's going on. Yeah. And then, you know, then follow the regular agenda item.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because that's where everybody seems to always come at the beginning, and then...
And they drift away.
Yeah. It's an important issue.
Yeah. Well, if you notice, actually, most flooding issues, we have put it first on the agenda for that reason. So, you're not alone. You won't get slapped later, don't you?
Okay.
Not that I ever slapped you. Just for the record.
Okay. So, then the... so we know what we're going to do. There's no reason to schedule another meeting at this time.
I think so.
Well, it's up to you. It depends how hard it is to get you all around. You have seven people here. That's hard to get all everybody.
Yeah, I'd like to plan ahead.
This would be for the workshop that we're talking about now. We're talking about for the workshop that the proposed
that.
Workshop.
So, preliminary date, and we'll see if the commissioners can make it. You've got three from here, so.
Next October, I'm available after the 22nd of October. So if a month later would be 28th would be a Monday. But Saturday the 26th of October would be about a month from now. Maybe that's too soon for the October 12th meeting for the commission, so that's probably not going to work. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's mid-November for the joint workshop.
I'm thinking that, yeah.
So this is my input. I can make that easily.
I don't have a calendar. You got so what is it? November Saturday's like in
Saturday 16th of November.
Can I ask when Thanksgiving is? I'm sorry. I'm just
I want to say it's the 28th or 20, something like that. I'm not sure.
It's third Thursday, which...
Is it 28th? 28th?
Yes,
it is the 28th.
So the Saturday the 16th is 6 weeks from today, basically. So, and it's a month after the commissioner's meeting, so it's... Seems like a good pencil-in date at the moment.
Okay.
Is that on November 16th?
Yeah, November 16th. Right.
You want to do this 10 a.m.?
You know what? I don't know whether I'm going to be here at that meeting. So let's try it to 10 a.m. On the 16th, Saturday the 16th.
11:16.
All right.
I move we adjourn.
Yeah. Okay.
And that'll be done at the. I mean, the commissioners will schedule that at the October 12th meeting, and they may want to change it, but that's at least what we would be sympathetic.
And that's the most.
All right. Very good. Thank
you. Okay. We have a motion to adjourn. Do I hear a second?
Second.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Thank you. Thanks, you everyone,
thank
for attending.
You.
So. Kind of like a new device here because